How can we make the radical social changes needed to address the climate crisis? What kind of large ecological disaster or mass mobilization in the streets needs to take place before we take meaningful climate action? Dana R. Fisher is the director of the Center for Environment, Community and Equity and a professor in the School of International Service at the American University. Fisher's research focuses on questions related to democracy, civic engagement, activism, and climate politics. Her current projects include studying political elites' responses to climate change, the ways Federal Service Corps programs at the U.S. are integrating climate into their work. She's a self-described climate apocalyptic optimist and co-developed the framework of Anthroshift to explain how social actors are reconfigured in the aftermath of widespread perceptions and experiences of risk. Her seventh book is Saving Ourselves from Climate Shocks to Climate Action. Dana Fisher, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we dive into the conversation, I believe you're going to share a passage from your book, Saving Ourselves from Climate Shocks to Climate Action.
Yes, I decided I would read this section from chapter one called No One Else is Going to Save Us. And there's been a lot of discussion about my apocalyptic optimistic perspective. So I am going to read the section called Making the Case for Apocalyptic Optimism. Even though the environmental side effects of the responses to COVID-19 were unintentional, the way society responded to the pandemic provides some guidance regarding what is needed to save ourselves. Risk only motivates an anthroshift if it surpasses a threshold in terms of its duration and intensity. Without a sustained shock that has tangible consequences in terms of social cost to people and property, the subsequent social change, like we saw during the early days of the pandemic, will be ephemeral. In those cases, the reorientation of social actors will shift back towards the original configuration that maintains a business-as-usual trajectory. This trajectory is supported and encouraged by the many actors with vested interests that have consolidated access to resources and power through the fossil fuel-based economy. The changes required to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, as outlined by the IPCC, are substantial. They require both halting the emissions of greenhouse gases and the adoption of some negative emissions technologies that would remove greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. These technologies have yet to be proven to work at the scale necessary. This degree of social change is impossible without a radical transformation in the ways that the state, the market, and civil society sectors interact. The most common examples of drastic social change in response to crisis are war, natural disaster, and economic depression, which have been noted by the IPCC's most recent report as possible consequences of climate change. The type of radical social change needed is most likely to be initiated by civil society, a global mass mobilization that employs either nonviolent or more confrontational tactics has the potential to be successful in bringing about such large-scale social transformations if a critical mass of 3.5% or more of the population participate in the activism. Beyond responses to repressive and autocratic rule, however, examples of sustained activism at this level of engagement are scant. Thus, it is unrealistic to imagine that such a high percentage of the population would mobilize and engage in a peaceful climate activism without some sort of large-scale risk pivot to motivate it. It is possible that less peaceful forms of activism could lead to the kinds of radical social changes that are needed to address the climate crisis. In fact, calls for such confrontational activism are growing. To date, however, we are nowhere near the level of mass mobilization that is expected to be associated with the type of systemic social change required to respond to the climate crisis. It is also worth noting that there is a continuum of activism that ranges from peaceful to violent protests. Even when activism starts out peaceful, confrontational tactics like roadblocks, sit-ins, and human barriers that are designed to be nonviolent run the risk of turning violent due to interactions with counter-protesters or the response of law enforcement. Repression can easily lead to an escalation of violence on both sides. I call myself an apocalyptic optimist. In other words, I do believe that there is hope to save ourselves from the climate crisis that we have all caused. However, I also believe that saving ourselves will only be possible with a mass mobilization that is driven by the pain and suffering of climate shocks around the world. A generalized sense of extreme risk can lead to peaceful and less peaceful mass mobilizations at the levels needed to stimulate an anthroshift. Only a global risk event or numerous smaller ones that are seen as threatening social and economic centers of power will motivate the kind of massive and social change that is needed. In other words, without a risk, be it driven by social or environmental change, an anthroshift that is large enough to respond adequately to the climate crisis and open a large enough window of opportunity post-shock is improbable. At this point, it is impossible to predict if such a shock will come from ecological disaster, war, pandemic, or another unforeseen risk. What is certain, though, is that without such a shock that motivates an answer shift large enough to reorient all the actors of society to respond meaningfully to the climate crisis, it is hard to envision the world achieving the levels of climate action needed. Instead, the best we can hope for is incremental change that does not disrupt the dominant nodes of political and economic power. Such incremental change has the potential to reduce the gravity of the crisis, but it will not stop the coming climate crisis.
Yeah, I like the optimism part of it. I mean, you've been at this for over 30 years, so I think
Let's say 25 years.
it's a life's work.
It's a life's work, yes, for sure.
Yeah, and yet I see, you know, positive things in that. I mean, 3.5% coming out onto the streets. I know that's based on, you said, studies within like autocratic societies. So that doesn't seem like huge to me. I mean, I don't understand why there isn't more incremental change, because everyone I'm surrounded by is committed their whole life or a great part of their life to it.
I just would say that 3.5% of the population marching in the streets, we haven't seen that even in almost any society around, particularly not advanced industrial society. I mean, that's 12 million Americans. To give you a sense of it, more than 12 million Americans. And in France, it's a substantial proportion of the population as well. So it's not huge, but as they talk about in the book, and as you mentioned, there are ways to get at the kind of pressure with a smaller, more concentrated group of people who really care about the issue and are willing to push for the changes. But we can't do it alone. That's one of the whole points.
Yes. And I think that we have to also, and I know that's not the focus of your book, but even adopt, I don't want to say the dirty tactics, but the marketing skills of the lobbyists, which is so poisoned the system, because they are skilled communicators.
Absolutely. And I think that if we're not willing to get our hands dirty in terms of, you know, getting involved in marketing and doing a good job of taking advantage of the communication tools that exist to get the message out in a way that really gets to everybody, you know, we're doing the whole planet a disservice.
And you mentioned there the IPCC, and I know that you're a contributing author on the Working Group 3 of Sixth Assessment Report. And I think it was today, The Guardian just polled hundreds of the world's leading climate scientists, and 80% of them expect global temperatures to rise at least 2.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
It's also terrible that we are, in our 13th month of record-breaking temperatures, and sea surface temperatures are off the charts. I think it's worth noting that I talk in the book about a previous survey of IPCC authors, and they already said that 1.5 degrees was not possible. I mean, we've known this. Anybody who's in the scientific world has known that we are on a really terrible path, and we are at risk of cascading environmental problems, which is what that article in The Guardian was talking about. So it's not new, but I think a lot of scientists, as well as policymakers, particularly people in the United Nations, are screaming and yelling and pulling their hair out, trying to be heard.
Yeah. And then it's dealing with that, which they were always saying then maybe dealing with a 2-degree world, but now a 2.5 degree world, I can't even imagine. The famine, as you outlined, the conflicts, the mass migration, the heat waves, the wildfires, the floods, and the storms of such an intensity and frequency, then that'll be the anthropogenic shift, perhaps, that'll get us moving. But I also wonder about that, because I know that some are able to find vitality and movement when a catastrophe hits. And I know that there's another tendency within some of us to just freeze. Like you see that with the tsunami. The animals know how to flee. They sense it coming before anyone else. And you see the humans, they're just staring at the wave coming.
I think one of the things that I've had a lot of conversations as I was on book tour with different scholars, and there's this window where people will feel like they still can make a difference. One of the things that I've been talking a lot about is that the research I've done on climate activists recently is that for people who are engaged in climate activism, they're really experiencing the climate crisis firsthand and feeling anger about it. And anger is a wonderful motivator. It is true that at a certain point, things will get so bad that people may very well freeze or may become extremely tribal and mostly focused on saving themselves and their individual families rather than the broader work of saving ourselves, which is needed. I think that the moment for us to save ourselves is coming up, and it's coming soon. If we wait too long, things could get so bad that at least in certain parts of the world, it'll just be too late.
Yes, and we're not even taking into account climate-induced migration. You know, the UN International Organization for Migration estimates that up to 1.4 billion people potentially will be migrating by 2060. And what's good about your book, I find, you talk about tribalism, it's also about identifying your tribe, your community, those grassroots movements, community movements, and cultivating that sense of climate resilience. We know, which actually can be, we're so disconnected. We don't have a sense of community. But I think when it comes to these catastrophes, we have to have it. And it, despite all the despair, there's beauty in that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was living in New York City when 9/11 happened. And one of the things that we were all very worried about, and right in the beginning, when right after the first plane hit, I lived uptown because I was teaching at Columbia University. So I thought we really should go out and buy water because, you know, a disaster's coming. What are you going to do? You buy water. I mean, we were just like, we got to go and buy some canned goods and water just in case the world is about to end. So we went out, and on our way to the supermarket right around in our neighborhood, these other people saw us carrying gallons of water out and taking them home. And they said, don't take them all. And I thought, oh my gosh, we could end up in this really scary world that's a really apocalyptic, horrible place where people are fighting one another. But that's not what happened at all. When the day was over and the buildings had both fallen down and a whole section of the city was basically closed down and people were unhoused. And I had students who had been lost. Thankfully, I didn't have any students who perished that day, but some of them had gotten trapped because they stopped all trains. You couldn't come in or out of Manhattan. And by that night, people had posted pictures of loved ones who were missing, and they were candles that people had put on the street corners that they had burning at all times in memory of the people who had lost and those who had fallen. And it was just, it was beautiful the way that the community, a community that was really quite atomized. I mean, we in New York City, it's not known for being a very embedded and tight community of neighbors, right? But people came out and were supporting one another in such a beautiful way. And I think that that's what we can see. And there are stories like that after other disasters as well. And so we need to take hope from the fact that's how people tend to respond. But I also do think that cultivating our communities better so that we're connected better and cultivating social resilience so that we're available to support one another as disasters come is absolutely necessary and will be the difference in the ways that we all experience the climate crisis.
Yes. And one thing that has grown out of this book or your lifetime commitment to this, you were saying that there's an American Climate Corps that, just tell us about that. A lot of people don't know about it.
Well, I mean, the American Climate Corps was not my idea, but I have been very lucky to be able to be involved in helping to evaluate it as it built out. The American Climate Corps builds on the legacy of Civilian Conservation Corps that came out of the New Deal, which was after the Great Depression in the United States. When the country was getting very close to there being a toppling of the government because there was such a crisis here after the Depression, there were dust bowls, people were migrating all over the country to try to find work. And it was a really dark time in the United States. So part of the New Deal included establishing this conservation corps where young men could go to work and they'd earn a livable wage and they'd work on teams and they would help to build things in the United States. And some of them planted trees, so some of it was conservation. They helped with the railroads. They built all sorts of things with the Army Corps of Engineers. So there has been a call for a while now to build an American Climate Corps, which is building off of this legacy. The Biden administration finally announced the American Climate Corps last September during Climate Week. And one of the unfortunate things about the Climate Corps is that it builds on this amazing legacy, but it didn't receive much funding because the funding was originally going to be part of the Build Back Better Act, which was the climate-related policy that ended up being reformulated and repackaged as the Inflation Reduction Act. The Climate Corps was not funded as part of that. So it's coming out in a much more limited manner. But what it basically is doing is merging a number of pre-existing programs that are designed to help train young people to do work around climate change, broadly defined, across different agencies in the U.S. government, to train them so that they have experience working on addressing climate change in a variety of ways, and also have a pathway into doing green jobs, be they in the federal government or nonprofits or elsewhere in the government. And so the hope is that it will expand out to be thousands, if not more than thousands, tens of thousands of jobs. And that's the promise of the Climate Corps, but we have to see how it works out because as somebody who works with the federal government a lot, I know that the president can propose these amazing policies, but part of it is about congressional funding to see what's possible. So the big question is what kind of funding will come through to support it. This summer will be the first Climate Corps will hit the ground, and the first Corps will be focusing on addressing forest fires, which are driven by drought and exacerbated by climate change. And we've seen a lot of that out west. So there'll be some programs that are partnerships between the AmeriCorps federal program and the U.S. Forest Service to get young people trained to help to address forest fire and to limit forest fires.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear about it because we know we work with a lot of students, including those within your university and elsewhere, and they want to be more involved. They're involved as much as they can, but it's so wonderful to have that structure, even though the funding is still growing.
I am cautiously optimistic that if the Biden administration gets a second term in office, that this program will continue to grow. And it really has the potential to be an amazing resource for training young people and helping them to understand all the ways that they can do work and cultivate resilience in communities, which is so necessary for addressing the climate crisis. I'm really excited to be a part of it. We're going to be building out a curriculum to help people understand the kind of service you can do that is about resilience, as well as reducing emissions, as well as recovery and restoration of communities. So I'm very excited about it. It's a whole lot of potential right now, but it's the kind of potential that really could make a difference.
As you analyze the protests, the peaceful protests and those that are more, we see this right now. We see the protests on university campuses. I'm sure you're seeing it. You probably saw it today. So we don't know if Biden will get that second term. Just analyze it, because you said that that's something that we can learn from that for the climate protests.
So the movement right now on college campuses is a very interesting movement. In some ways, it's what social movement scholars like myself would call a moment of madness. And the reason that I call it that rather than a more traditional type of protest is that frequently protests and large scale mobilizations are organized through groups that coordinate for a long period of time to develop and organize a mobilization. That is like a big demonstration or an event. And they bring in people from all over to affect change. They have specific demands, et cetera, and so forth. In this moment, what we've seen is that there has been a big push by young people, particularly concern about what's going on with the war in Gaza and a lot of demands for there to be a ceasefire, which went unanswered. What happened is that the students on Columbia University's campus decided to start an encampment, which I should just say is a very common tactic on Columbia's campus. It's a common tactic on campuses all over the United States. What's unique about this moment is that the Columbia University administration, for a range of reasons, called in the New York City Police Department to clear the encampment very quickly. And they came in with force that was extremely aggressive for these peaceful, nonviolent activists who were engaging in civil disobedience. And as a result of that repression against the nonviolent protesters, first of all, more people came out the next day and there was a big mobilization on Columbia's campus. But we also saw encampments spring up across the United States. And I talk about this in the book, that it's very common that when people are engaging in civil disobedience, particularly nonviolent civil disobedience, what you would expect, and we have seen this, when nonviolent activists are met with repression, what happens is it escalates the mobilization, and it can also create much more confrontational and even violent activism. What we saw on Columbia's campus in response to this, some of the activists occupied a building, and while they were not being violent to humans, they did destroy property and pulled out the furniture. It looked like they were preparing to have a bonfire, which is a standard tactic. And once again, riot police were called. So we've really seen the way that law enforcement has militarized in the United States. These are examples of it. The police response to a lot of these protests has been much more aggressive and much quicker than it was during the 1960s, where in most cases, National Guard and riot police were not called in until buildings were blown up. So we're seeing it happening much faster, but it does tell us about how climate activists will likely be facing repression as well. I mean, we see climate activists facing repression, certainly in the UK and other parts of Europe.
Yes. Talk about if we reach that 3.5%, that's what's going to mobilize. And I hope it doesn't reach that point because lives will be lost. Of course, lives are already being lost. I think over 8 million people are dying each year due to air pollution. So it's just more, it's not really incremental. It's just sort of silent.
Well, there's not a lot of people, and there's been some interesting research recently about the fact that we don't really know how many people are losing lives because of extreme heat, right? Extreme events, climate change exacerbated events, which I call climate shocks in the book. We haven't been counting that. I think we will start counting it and we'll get a better sense of the trend. But there's no doubt that the numbers are going up, even though we aren't sure about the exact numbers globally. you had that estimate. I would just say that with regard to the amount of people we need in the streets, again, I'm very cautious about putting a number on it. What we do know is we need a lot more people pushing back against power, particularly given the way that fossil fuel interests are continuing to push, to greenwash, to try very hard to affect decision making. I mean, there was an article that just came out today in the Washington Post about how the Trump administration is trying very hard to attract funds for supporting the campaign from oil companies with the promise that all regulations will be gone, right? And this shows us what the type of crossroads we're at, because it's not just the United States where some fossil fuel interests are pushing very hard. They're supporting elected officials and they're pushing for decision making that reflects their interests, which is not in the interest of the planet. And it's certainly not in the interest of the general public, which is going to be facing these climate shocks that will come more frequently and with more severity with every incremental degree that we warm.
And of course, we know that at the COP conferences, lobbyists often outnumber the actual activists or the politicians. It's what we feel it on the good side of the fight. And then there are those kind of shocking reports released by F-, the way that lobbyists are using other organizations, even packaging themselves, hiding behind green movements or arts organizations, so that they're being represented by the same PR companies.
Yeah, we saw some really good examples of this in the United States this year with specific quote unquote civic groups that were actually funded by fossil fuel interests or funded by the fossil fuel industry to show backlash to wind power that was supposed to come to the coast. And it basically obfuscated people's opinions and led to there being less support for wind power. And this kind of thing is very common. We see it in a lot of cases. Fossil fuel companies are much more likely to say the quiet part out loud now. So when I used to go to climate negotiations, I was going back when people were negotiating the Kyoto Protocol and beyond that. And there we used to see that the fossil fuel interests would come in very much undercover. I know at the most recent COP, OPEC itself had its own pavilion. You would have never seen that back in the 1990s or in the early aughts. But now they are trying to present themselves as a pathway towards the other side of the climate crisis, which is just absolutely not true. But it confuses people. And that kind of marketing is really problematic for mobilizing the masses to take the actions that are needed to address the climate crisis.
And I know, of course, you've addressed and attended a number of those conferences. And I guess in the beginning, obviously, you feel like something's happening. So you're talking now about how healthy communities are those that will help each other. Just discuss how you've been involved with them and what are those positive stories?
Well, I would just say that what we know today is that, first of all, we are all going to be experiencing climate change in our communities, and we may experience it through extreme weather. But what we also know is that when those types of events come, there are opportunities for people in communities to work together, to build more solidarity across identities, orientations, and concerns. In fact, we're about to get storms right now because it's been extremely hot for May, just like it is around the world right now. And the best thing you can do is work with your community to start to help support people so that they can be ready for those kinds of shocks. In general, we know from research that makes stronger communities, better towns and villages, and better towns and villages make better countries because it makes us better citizens. So as you mentioned, this report in The Guardian, we can't stop it. We're here. The climate crisis is upon us. It's going to be a very long, hot summer. There's going to be a lot of protests, a lot of activism, a lot of people feeling cheated and threatened by the world and the way the world is going. And what we need to do is support one another and create opportunities both to train young people so they have ideas of how they can help make the world a better place and get jobs and think about and envision a life even with the climate crisis, because that's one of the things that is limiting some people in terms of envisioning a future.
Yes, we can gain profound insights when we come together as communities. And I was also interested to read how it's the very youngest and the older segment in society, the majority of civic engagement come together around this. So it can be an opportunity for intergenerational exchange.
For sure. And now what we're seeing, because the climate movement is not particularly mobilized right now. And so what we see is the people with the most time who tend to be involved actively, which basically means that we have young people always tend to get really engaged around movements, and they are most likely because they have the most free time. And what's really interesting right now is that we're also seeing older people, particularly retirees who are identifying as elders, who came of age during earlier waves of the environmental movement or the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement in the United States, who are working with young people and providing support and mentorship. And it's really quite something. But I mean, obviously, those of us in the middle, we need to step up. But I think as the climate crisis worsens, we are going to all have to get involved and let the young people and the older people lead, and we can follow. That's fine.
And there's an emotional aspect to all this, of course. And there are studies, and I'm sure you've seen these, that the changing climate changes us internally. It changes our ability actually to cope because we're distressed, but also changing our minds. So how do you deal with those emotional inner landscapes heating up?
Yeah, that's something that I think we do need to worry about a lot, because there's reason to despair. There's a reason to feel anxious, and lots of people are having those emotions. What I think is really heartening, though, is that when I've gone out into crowds and surveyed protesters, and I did this at the March 10 fossil fuel right before the UN meeting last fall, one of the things that I did is I added a question to my survey to ask about emotions. And I thought maybe we could look for patterns for how people were feeling and who was feeling anxious, who was feeling despair. And one of the most heartening things I found was that while most of the crowd reported feeling sad about the climate crisis, 86% also felt angry. And anger is a wonderful emotion to feel when you feel like you can make a difference. And you get angry, and then you get even, or you take back power. And that is exactly what we need to be doing right now. So I encourage everybody to get angry and take action.
Indeed, that internal activism can also then lead to that external activism. And I know that you have some criticism about the Inflation Reduction Act not having enough teeth, but will Biden be reelected? At least he's in the right direction.
Well, for sure. In the United States right now, if the candidates and the presumed candidates are, we have Biden versus Donald Trump. In a lot of ways, it is the election to determine our future, because while the Biden administration, I wish he had done more, he also was limited by the Congress and who was in the Congress and the interests that were around it. He certainly has done more than any other president before him. And I am really excited to see what he can do if he gets a second term. And we know, if Trump has a second term in office, the second Trump administration will be much worse on climate change. He will reduce any efforts that have been implemented to address climate change using all the powers he has available to him. So given that, there's no question that I hope that we see another Biden administration. And it's way too early to be looking at polls. There was a poll yesterday that came out that had Biden leading. I also know that the protests on college campuses are being used by the right to try to get conservatives to support Trump as a candidate. So I think right now all bets are off. We have to just wait and see what comes of it. But I am very hopeful that if Biden has a second term, it will be a wonderful thing for the planet. It certainly will be better for the planet than a second Trump administration.
And given your basic theory that we need to bring home this sense of the risk of climate shock, these kind of apocalyptic visions or just experience extreme deprivation on some level, I'm wondering if there's some way we can get that. I don't know. Can AI help create visions of this? We do talk about deep fakes or synthetic media. Some ways that can bring home, instead of maybe the climate modeling that we see, something so that we don't have to experience that.
That's a really interesting question. Nobody's asked me that before. I mean, I'm concerned about AI because of the type of energy consumption that goes into using AI. And that makes me very nervous about encouraging more use of the AI because it is so consumptive. What I actually think we really need is we need to shift away from the climate modeling and more towards the social modeling. There are so many things that we know we can do that contribute to making the world a better place. And the question is, which ones are the most effective? I mean, the other thing that I really am hoping to try to do, but I have yet to find funding to do it, is we need to model out what kind of activism is most effective for achieving goals. One of the things that Third Act has been doing, which is a group that's led by retirees here in the United States, took rocking chairs and they hand painted them different colors and they carry them around to protest and they put them down and they block entrances and they sit in their rocking chairs and they rock back and forth and they talk about the climate crisis and why they're blocking entrance to something. And it's very performative, but it's a beautiful message. And it's a really great way of giving that message.
I have to say that I'm not a person who is so much in the streets activism. This is the kind of activism I do, like working with faculty and students and getting them to be part of the story and then learning from people like you. So people are listening, but sometimes people are just a little bit shy about putting their feet on the ground in the street.
Well, as I say in the book, It's going to take all of us doing everything that we can. And what we need to do is figure out what's your superpower. And Mia, clearly this is your superpower. So you do such a great job with getting the message out and working to help educate the public. And that's a superpower. We need everybody to figure out what their superpower is and use it for the good of stopping the climate crisis. Limit it. I mean, we can't stop it, but we can limit the climate crisis. I think that data is my superpower. So that's where I focus my time. And I train people. I train students and postdocs about how to collect data, analyze data, use data, and then I try to communicate that to the public. But I think that it's going to take all of us doing anything that we can and everything that we can to get to the other side. And there are some people whose superpower is marching in the streets and creating the kind of disruption that opens windows of opportunity for social change. And we'll need to educate people about what kind of social changes are necessary. So I think we're all needed. And what we really need is for people to recognize that we all need to come together to work on this and stop this problem. But I do believe in people power, and I believe that it's not too late, but I also believe we need to be realistic about the kinds of experiences we're going to be having because of climate change. It is going to be a long, hot summer.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be all summer, perhaps. Yeah. Well, no, we'll have the other extremes, too. Thinking, and this is a big question, but you're talking about the social aspect, but we're living in the century of the city. A decade, of course, transformation. Cities are the main drivers of creativity and innovation and is consuming 75% of the world's natural resources and accounting for over 70% of global carbon dioxide emissions. So what do you foresee in terms of transport and waste management, pollution, water infrastructure? What are your reflections on, you know, what the cities of the future will look like or what we could do to make them better?
One of the things that's beautiful about cities is when done well, they require individuals to consume a lot less carbon than if you live in places like I live right outside Washington, D.C. But where I live, we just have a lot more space. There's much less public transit, and it makes a big difference in how much carbon we consume. I mean, my family, we put solar panels on our house, we use electric cars, but they're still, it's just much harder. So what I would love to see is more cities that are embracing and encouraging public transit. I know Paris has done some really innovative things with regard to creating green space, creating opportunities for people to use bikes and other types of individual transportation options, as well as investing in public transit. The other thing that we can see that I think is really important is transitioning away from natural gas in terms of the way that we cook. So that's something that a lot of people are starting to focus on, as well as the way that we heat our houses and our apartments. And that's something that is infrastructural that's necessary to be built, particularly in cities. But I think that there's a lot of discussion about how cities of the future will transition and not use natural gas, which will be really valuable for the amount of carbon that's released from a city and the amount that's being consumed by the individuals. So I'm going to be in Paris in less than a month. I'll be there to as part of my book tour, but I'm going to be doing an event with the Sociological Association of France, talking about the book and doing some conversations about it. And I can't wait. I haven't been back to Paris in a while, and I'm super excited to see all the transitions. I was reading about all the amazing things that you all have done to make the city greener, and the way that your mayor has been working to have the Olympics happen in a successful way that is not as heavy on infrastructure that's a waste, but rather helping to make everybody have a better life. So I think France is a wonderful, or Paris is a wonderful example to look at.
Thank you, Dana Fischer, for your wonderful insight. It certainly is further testament to the ever-changing world we live in. With record-breaking temperatures across the globe, there is no doubt that the Earth is warming, and much of the population is already suffering the consequences of it. This is further proof of the immediate and critical need for change, not only through human behavior, but also attitude. Like Fischer said, if we do not take charge and take action, but rather passively stand by watching the Earth succumb to the destructive forces of global warming, then we will condemn humanity to a rather tragic end. Fischer's first chapter resonated deeply with me. Humans alone are responsible for the climate crisis, and we alone can change the fact. We as both individuals and a collective must be active agents of change through environmental advocacy. However, the question of how is yet to be affirmed, and with the more time that passes, the opportunity for environmental redemption becomes more and more improbable. Nonetheless, I admire Fischer's optimism. Humanity has overcome many burdening obstacles in the past, and in a time of crisis, with the right faculty, humans can converge to achieve a collective end goal. That being said, it does seem easier said than done. It's definitely heartening to see the contemporary changes that nations and governments are adopting in order to reduce gas emissions and pollution. Many European countries are encouraging renewable energy, electric cars and utilities, etc. These powers are trying to make a difference, but while this is a right step in the direction, we cannot rely too heavily on external authorities to make changes alone. I believe many people adopt the bystander effect, where they believe that they are too insignificant of a role to commit to being active advocates for environmental health, and instead hand over the responsibility to others believed to be more capable. By realizing one's elemental role in addressing the climate crisis, various groups of people can be united to fight for the noble and environmental cause. While it is important to remain optimistic, for the fight against climate crisis has not yet ended, it is only human nature to strive for money, power, and success, and many of the policies that aid in reducing global warming also negatively impact politicians, businesses, and a large percentage of the wealthy demographic. Naturally, these policies stir tension and conflict, as many hold different beliefs and perspectives. It may seem far-fetched that someone with so much to lose will make such a sacrifice to help the environment and others but himself. With populations so large, it is imperative to figure out a way for social coalition and collaboration without conflict and disagreements. Otherwise, the overwhelming number of divergent belief systems will inhibit complete cooperation, and people will never become equal.
So how do you think that those in the media could be reframing the crisis? And journalism is undergoing its own crisis, uncertain about its future and future of journalism in a post-truth world. So what are your general reflections on that?
Well, one of the things that I hope for with journalism is, I mean, first of all, I would really like to encourage journalists to be more skeptical when they get messages from businesses, because they have really fallen prey to greenwashing and been ensnared by greenwashing that has been marketed really, really well by industry to talk about how green companies are that are burning so many fossil fuels and how their efforts will be balanced out by carbon capture, which isn't actually happening, but they say it's happening. And I think that the media has a very important role to play in providing accurate depictions of what's going on in the world with regard to climate change, in terms of the effects of climate change and the solutions to climate change. And spending so much time talking about technologies that don't actually work and don't scale up is also confusing the general public. So I think that there's really important jobs that journalism can do. And I think that part of it is also about journalists learning more about the climate crisis and how the climate crisis works, what causes it, and what the solutions are before writing about it. Because I've spoken to many journalists who are very new to the subject, so they don't actually have a sense of the history and of the way the process works and where we are and how we got here.
And with all of this, what are we fighting for?
Well, I just finished teaching a class on activism and the environment, my graduate class on that. And one of the things that we talked about is how most movements and moments of social change came with a lot of cultural artifacts being produced. And we haven't seen as much of that around climate yet, but we really could use some climate and protest songs. I know Macklemore just released a song around the protests on the campuses in response to the war in Gaza. But I think that, you know, we need obviously a lot more than just Macklemore releasing one song. But historically, we see cultural production that helps to motivate and inspire. And this is a really great time for that. But I think we are just in the early days of seeing how that will play out.
It makes me think of that song, which is still as fresh today, Where Will the Children Play?
Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
So as you think about the future, what you say to your students, your son, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve?
Well, for young people, I think that it's really important to be honest and say that we're in for it's going to be a bit of a crazy ride, but we're in this together. And particularly we as adults, those of us who have been around for a while, we need to start thinking through how we can be responsible and teach responsibility to our children, and also teach our children how to be hopeful and understand how they can be part of the solution. Because it's going to take all of us, no matter where we are, what we're doing, it's going to take all of us working together to get to the other side of the climate crisis. And as unfair as it may seem, the future is up to us. So we have to make it what we want to actualize, a future that supports as many people as possible and that doesn't destroy the planet.
Well, it's been inspiring. So thank you, Dana Fisher, for sharing ways that we can save ourselves, transform climate shocks to climate action, and find purpose and meaning and community in an age of climate crisis. By helping us find beauty and connection in despair, we can create our collective future. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you for having me.
On Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Sebastian Klassen. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.